The timeline, I believe, is critical. We are so past the point of how people even know what they can and can't trust. And a democracy cannot succeed if people have nothing to trust. If you can't trust the media, if you can't trust any government institution, if you can't trust a democratic process and that the election actually even happened in a legitimate way, then what's a democracy? It doesn't mean we're all going to die and life is going to be over. But democracy as we know it will be. And so then what comes next? I know that these companies think they're the grand disruptors, but they haven't actually offered us the, but when you disrupt democracy and you disrupt the media landscape, what alternative system are you offering us? Because your disruption has not offered us an alternative that is more peaceful and prosperous.
Hi, everyone. I'm Rana Sarkar, and you're listening to Confluence. Each week, we dive deep into the issue shaping tech, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lenses of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. This week, we're digging into pro-human technology, or humane tech. So what is pro-human technology? Essentially, it's rooted in innovation that works for real people in the real world and allows users to have access and agency over their data and networks. Ethicists and advocates around the world are hard at work trying to make sure the next big thing doesn't become the next big disaster. We'll be joined by Asa Raskin, former Google employee and co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology, and later from Yale Eisenstadt, Future of Democracy Fellow at the Begruen Institute. Both our guests are working at the intersection of advocacy, education, and policy to make sure that tech remains a tool for the good and not a tool for exploitation. With backgrounds in intelligence, engineering, politics, and more, it certainly wasn't a straight line for either Yale or ASA to make it into the world of humane technology. But with the rise of digital authoritarianism around the world, both found that this is the critical work we need right now. First, we sit down with ASA Raskin. He started the Center for Humane Technology, along with his partner Tristan Harris. Since the beginning, the center has become an influential inside voice in the Silicon Valley community.
You know, my background, I really think of myself as, like I think many people do, as the product of my parents, right? And on my father's side, you know, he created the Macintosh project at Apple. So in some sense, I was doomed to be a geek and have no friends in high school. And for him, really, you know, he coined the term humane for how a relationship with technology and humans should be. And he defined it as being considerate of human needs and protective of human frailties. And then there's also my mother's side. And, you know, she's in palliative care, nurse practitioner, has worked in hospice. And there's a very deep sense of one-on-one care and human dignity. And I think Center for Humane Technology's work, you can sort of see as a blending of these two things. There's sort of like the large scale of how do we make technology into a shape that when you press human beings into it, it doesn't break us.
To give us an overview of the current tech landscape and what the scope of the problem is, Asa shared a clever analogy.
It's as if, you know, like we now experience the world, it's intermediated through technology, information intermediation technology, Facebook, Google, Twitter, TikTok. It's how we get the inputs of the world. It's how we understand who and what of our friends are relevant to us. It's as if we've strapped a pair of binoculars to our eyes. And in real time, somebody else is modifying those binoculars. But because you're always seeing through it, it's not always clear to us that something has changed. You're getting lots of little changes over time. It's sort of an insidious kind of effect. I think the analogy we've been recently using is social media, but information technology in general, is a kind of brain implant for society. It's sort of like Neuralink, but instead of for an individual brain, it's for our collective brain. And what have we done with it? Well, one, notice that private companies are tinkering with that brain implant in real time. Two, you know, largely because of some of our work, but the sea change and starting to realize just how powerful these technologies are on society, Facebook has lost a lot of their best engineers. And so now it's sort of like you're a second or third rate technicians modifying your brain implant in real time with no oversight. And three, we've sort of wired up like what kind of connections have we created? Well, This is a maximum broadcast environment. So we've connected every neuron up to every other neuron in our societal brain. And what do we expect except to get sort of societal epileptic seizures? We're sort of like writhing on the ground, frothing at the mouth, unable to make decisions because we don't know what's true, what's not true. And so there's this incredible call to action now. And this is where there's hope. Just, you know, we haven't even ever tried to really regulate this stuff before. It's surveillance capitalism, attention capitalism. There's a huge amount of white space for us to decide, okay, we've seen the bad effects. But now, as we are fully into the 21st century, how do we structure this brain implant so that we can be a high-functioning society that can survive the challenges of the 21st century that doesn't fall to the, you know, it's not that technology is the existential threat. It's that the worst of society is an existential threat and technology is bringing out the worst of our society. We get to decide now, what does a 21st century democracy look like that upholds our values? And that to me is really exciting.
Like Asa, Yale also began to notice this pattern and the scope of the problem at hand in her career working at the CIA.
So the big shift happened. I had already left government, but in 2015, I was still working on global issues. Actually, at that time, I was heading a global political risk firm and started becoming more and more concerned about this just breakdown in discourse here in the US. And I felt seized to write about it because it just truly started to feel like the biggest threat to our democracy to me back in 2015. And so it's interesting, I wrote this piece. Now, I just have to make it clear, someone with my background does not necessarily want to put their name out there publicly. I had not even told most of my friends that I had ever been in the intelligence world or at the CIA. So it wasn't something I went into lightly. And I wrote this piece, and at the time I remember feeling like the title was super alarmist. And I actually told the Time magazine editor I thought that the title was too alarmist. I think the title was "American Hate is a Bigger Threat than Foreign Terrorism." And what I was trying to say in that piece is what's happening here, this sort of this vitriol, this breakdown in discourse, it's becoming a bigger threat to our democracy than any of the issues I worked on. And I used to head some of our counter-extremism work overseas. I was also the senior intel officer at the National Counterterrorism Center. So I feel like if someone like me says this is actually a bigger threat to our democracy, then hopefully some people would listen. And so I started digging in and looking at what was causing all of this, which sort of led me more and more to down a path of looking at social media, not as the reason that our country is divided or not as the reason that people act the way they do, but as a serious contributing factor to radicalizing people at a scale that we could not see happening before, when radicalization was really a hands-on, person-to-person process. And again, I worked on counter-radicalization and counter-extremism hands-on overseas for most of my career. So that's really what drew me to looking at how social media was factoring into all of this.
These are treacherous waters we're entering, and Yale has been watching the shifting tides for years now.
How would you reflect on that balance between human intel and tech these days? Like, obviously, you've seen the insides of tech companies and the work that's being done, you know, on the negative side as well, in terms of all of the counter intel and all of the work that's being done by bad actors. How would you see that terrain has shifted since you've left it?
I think that actually goes to the critical point of, in the tech industry, you do find, I'm not saying everyone, but you find this culture that believes that more tech will always be the solution. And then in some of the less tech industries, including some of the US government agencies, there's a lot of people who truly believe that human intelligence and human interaction is key. And it has to be a combination of both. And I think that's part of where the problem is right now is, at least in the US, I'm not sure how it works in Canada, but in the US, we spit out one or the other, right? Our education system spits out computer scientists and engineers. And, you know, I did my degrees in international affairs and African studies and real like social sciences. I think the tech industry needs more people like me, and government needs more people that are in the tech industry. One of the first talks I gave actually after leaving Facebook was about data without human intelligence. And it was just like, there is no matter how much data you want to analyze, if you do not understand human decision-making, human agency, actual motivations, political realities, there's not enough data in the world to actually fully help you understand what is happening. You might be able to see trends, see patterns. You definitely through data should be able to see, for example, if there was more insight into what was going on the platforms. The platforms had the insight. So that's a whole nother conversation. But I do believe that a data analyst would easily have been able to piece together. And I believe there are some organizations out there that did, that piece together, this is what's going to happen based on what we are seeing from, you know, Twitter feeds, from all of it. But you're always missing a piece when you don't have people who really understand the realities on the ground. And so it's not the most eloquent answer, but I found both sides when I was at Facebook, just the unbelievable, there was a strong desire by many of my teammates to really do the right thing, but boy, did they not understand some of the most basic human sides of why people are motivated a certain way. You know, can I give you an example? I wrote about this in a piece I wrote right after the January 6th attacks. You look at, for example, this woman who stormed the Capitol, and she was shot and killed storming the Capitol. And I did a deep dive into her Twitter feed as soon as her name came out. And it was before her Twitter feed will look totally different now because of how many people have been deplatformed or taken off of Twitter. But in those moments, I could see just all the QAnon conspiracies that she was retweeting and all of the biggest QAnon and conspiracy theorists and Stop the Steal people that she was retweeting like manically, like 35 times or something in a day. And it occurred to me that, okay, so a data scientist or a data analyst at Twitter might see that and think one thing, whereas I would have seen this individual as someone who left the military, was disillusioned with her civilian life, was struggling to adjust, was starting to get more and more, you know, following more and more sites about just sort of certain issues that just made her 100% vulnerable to extremist messaging. It was the exact same profile as somebody 10 or 15 years earlier. I could have told you kind of fit all the boxes of someone who's susceptible and vulnerable to extremist messaging. But I don't expect the person at Twitter to realize that about that individual, right? And so it's that back and forth of you kind of really need both.
Asa highlighted other threats that are scaling exponentially.
You know, the Center for Humane Technologies created a ledger that highlights how technology platforms have inadvertently unleashed invisible harms into society. And I wonder if you could walk us through what you think are the major challenges in that ledger right now that people should be focusing on.
The problem we were grappling with and trying to get out into the world, and now I think, or thankfully, this is no longer as surprising a message because it's out in the world, is that there's an interconnected set of harms that technology is creating. And it was as if there was cast your mind back before we had the term like climate crisis and global warming. And there were some people working on the ozone hole and other people working on coral bleaching and other people working on sea level rise and other people work on increasing numbers of hurricanes. And everyone was sort of pushing in a different direction. And if you can see that there's actually just one interconnected system that is creating global climate change, then you have a chance to start like working on it as a whole, as a collective. I think Charles Kittering has that line that a problem well stated is half solved, and a problem that's not understood is unsolvable. And I think that was the point, is being like, hey, look, human beings, we have a finite amount of attention. So if everyone is competing for that finite amount of attention with no regulations, then it becomes a knife fight, a race to the bottom of the brainstem. And then it's no longer enough to get people just using your product. You have to get people addicted to needing attention. That means insidiously changing their values. Not that anyone at the company set out to change human beings' values, but when you're surrounded by everyone else and you see that they're getting notoriety, fame, money from gathering more attention, you invisibly want to become more like that, which is how we've ended up. You know, last year, there was that poll that showed in the US, it used to be that the thing kids wanted to be when they grew up were like astronauts and teachers. And now the number one thing that kids want to be when they grow up is a YouTube influencer. It has insidiously changed our values. It's shortened our attention spans. So we cannot like think and operate in long form thought. We've actually seen the same thing happen, not just to us individually. Our attention spans get shorter, inability to read books, the nuance of our ideas go down, but it's happened to the media, right? Because social media has created a 24/7 instant, always short form mold into which the rest of traditional media has had to fit. And that's how you start to see traditional media picking up as news items, things from Twitter or things from TikTok. And so it's decreased the nuance and complexity and bandwidth which we as a society think. Then it's not just us as individuals, like government officials, like our leaders are caught in the exact same mind trap. It then pits us against each other. So, you know, there's an interesting idea we want to sort of explore it here of something like trauma bubbles. So we've heard, you know, Eli Pariser gave us the incredible phrase, filter bubbles, where we get fed more and more of the things that we like and it pulls us further apart. So we're just in little echo chambers of our own. But then it also smashes those little echo chambers together. Here's an example of how this might work. So trauma or the things you're triggered by are things you can't help but look at. So now imagine, let's cast our minds back just to say the Black Lives Matter protests. You're getting a feed, and let's say you're on the right, and you have a predisposition to thinking that there are violent protesters within BLM. So you see one video go by of a first-person narrative of a video of a protester's coming to that looks like a protester being violent. So you click on it, you watch it, you're like, oh no, how can this be? You see another video, you get the algorithm starts feeding this to you, and soon you are sort of trapped in a world where you have infinite first person evidence that the protests are violent. And now when somebody to the left comes and says, like, hey, the protests aren't violent, you're like, you are clearly not seeing the truth. I've just seen so many first person perspectives. I want to be careful, I'm not making a whataboutism or both sides are equal argument. I'm just sort of trying to highlight mechanisms here. Point is that this kind of entrenchification of people's beliefs into the first person perspectives is happening across every design, every divide, everywhere. And so if we cease to believe that the other side is coming in good faith and is a human, right? Because we're constantly seeing the worst. So that's the point, is that this is an interconnected system of harm that's downgrading fundamental human capacity to have a shared set of understanding so that we can operate together and solve these major issues. That's sort of like, I think, that's sort of top line.
Looking to governments, we're between a rock and a hard place. The question is, how much should be censored and who should be held accountable?
And you can decide as a government what you want to do to protect your public from whether it's disinformation, whether it's conspiracy theories, whether it's anti-vax campaigns. But this is where we get to the harder question of how do you define who's accountable for some of it and how do you stop it? And unfortunately, I think the rest of the world is sort of victim to the US's sort of over-reliance on the First Amendment as a reason to not do anything about it. And we can have that conversation if you want, because I am a full believer in the First Amendment. I do not believe what is happening in the social media world is a First Amendment issue.
You're a strong advocate for the freedom of public digital space and speech, and have spoken on social media platforms' dominance, you know, in these public spaces as being detrimental. How do governments defend these spaces?
So this is why I think the US is actually behind much of the world in how we think about how to defend these spaces. But unfortunately, these companies that are dominating these spaces, they're headquartered in the US. So it is incumbent on us to actually do something about it. So I think one of the biggest problems is early on, and I don't necessarily want to get into the whole history of Section 230, and it's not all about Section 230, but that plays into it here.
Quick rewind. Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act essentially protects social media platforms from being penalized for any harmful content published to their website by a third party, making the distinction between content creators and content carriers. This is a particularly American debate with global impact.
You know, early on in the 90s, it was this idea of trying to let the internet flourish. And I don't think Facebook was what anyone had in mind when they wrote Section 230, right? It was, that makes sense. There's this new thing called the internet. And we don't want everybody who ever tries to create an internet platform or company to feel like they're going to get nonstop lawsuits for what other people do with their software or with their sites. And that makes sense. But because of it, these platforms have been able to sort of hide behind this idea that they should be untouchable. And they're just sort of these neutral platforms, these pipes through which information runs. And all of the other stuff, the actual business practices, the actual design decisions, the way their recommendation engines work, the actual negligence of not taking action on things that you know are happening, all of that seems to get swept up in this idea of, well, free speech. You can't actually tell Facebook or Twitter or YouTube what to do because it's all about free speech and it's all about Section 230. And I just think that conversation has gotten so out of control that it has allowed these companies, listen, the rest of the world has to deal with the fact that these companies scaled very recklessly, let's be frank, because of this permissive environment that the United States afforded them. And then they exported this to the rest of the world based on these US ideals of, again, I always get jumped at when I have this conversation. Someone will take a half a sentence of what I say and say, she's anti-free speech. I am 100% for free speech. I am anti-business practices and tools that decide what to do with that speech. And that's the difference here. And so it's very difficult in the US because whenever government starts looking at how to tackle this issue, and yes, many of us would have hoped they would have taken certain things more seriously well before January 6th, but since January 6th, there's no question that lawmakers know there's something wrong. They know no matter how Facebook tries to spin it, the insurrection at the Capitol was planned on their platform. I mean, it was, and it was not just planned on their platform, but it was planned by people who I can guarantee you, if we were ever allowed to actually bring lawsuits against Facebook for it, we would find that it wasn't just that these people believed in Stop the Steal and then went and planned this insurrection, but that many of them were actually drawn into these groups because of Facebook recommendations, or connected with other people because the algorithms connected them, or were targeted with advertisements that were feeding on these ideas. Like, this is where it gets very complicated.
Asa used another clever analogy of a magic trick and the illusion of choice being fed to us by our algorithmic environments.
You know, I think magicians were sort of the very first, if you will, A/B testers, experimenters on human psyche, because they have a kind of asymmetric knowledge about how your mind works. And no matter how smart you are, how many PhDs you have, they still work. And in fact, there's an inverse correlation. Generally, the more certain you are of your own knowledge, the more PhDs you have, the better magic works on you because you think they don't even more. And I think that's a very useful frame because it gives us a compassionate way of looking at the limitations of our own mind. Working on humane technology is at least as difficult as working on your own ego. And magic gives, you know, you license to be like, aha, I was fooled, and then laughed about it. The analogy is, you know, the kinds of technology we now create are persuasive technologies. They can, right, the business model of Facebook, Google, et cetera, you could say it's ads, and that's sort of right, but really what's being monetized is the change to our behavior. That's the only thing that's being monetized, which means, you know, all of the data that's collected, and I think we should replace data with history of decisions, like all the history of decisions that are collected about us, because once you realize this history of decisions, it's very easy to realize, easy to make predictions about what you're going to do next or where you would intervene to change your kinds of decisions you make. That is, this is an attack against human agency, which is, again, a magic analogy. Magic is a way of knowing something about somebody else's mind that lets you take over their agency in a way that they're not even aware that you just did. And so Google, Facebook, Twitter, they have at least as much asymmetric knowledge about you than a magician or a lawyer or a doctor does, right? Like when you go to a doctor or a therapist, you have to tell them things that they can use to exploit you. You have to tell them your weaknesses, otherwise they can't do their job. They have a kind of asymmetric power over you. And Google, Facebook, all these big data companies, we sort of have this in the social dilemma. They're collecting all these history decisions, and it sort of creates this voodoo doll model of you that starts to look and act sort of like you. And so they know which buttons and where to press to make you do what they want. That's a kind of asymmetric power. And for relationships like therapists and doctors, they're covered under a fiduciary duty, a duty of care, where they have to act in your best interest. Just a couple of things that the big tech companies can predict using the data they already have, but like whether you're about to lose a job, whether you're depressed, when you got depressed, using just like, if you just have access to a webcam and watch your eyes, they can tell who you're attracted to. They know your sexual proclivities before you do, your fetishes. They know what drugs you're on, whether you're drunk, whether you've taken MDMA, if you're having an affair, where you're having an affair. It's an incredible asymmetric amount of information. So they too should be bound under a kind of duty of care or fiduciary relationship. And so I think that's sort of the mental image of why magic is such a good frame, is because the magician says, pick a card, any card, and you think you've picked a card, but in fact, somebody else has picked for you.
So how can we get back to actually having a real choice in all of this? The answer might lie not only in global cooperation, but also thinking about particular nation states and their unique needs.
But where does global diplomacy fit into this conversation? And where can other countries also be participants in some of this conversation right now?
That's a great question, because part of the real tension here is that nothing that happens online just happens in the United States, right? It's happening all over the world. These companies have exported their ideology to the rest of the world because of the way we've allowed them to scale. But on the flip side, so I have always advocated, and when I was in Facebook trying to work on elections issues, not just in the US, by the way, the answer all the time of like, well, does this solution you're trying to pass here, does it scale globally? And I would always say, well, no, not really, but this is very specific to this particular country's election and their particular laws, norms, and political consequences. And why I bring that up in the context of your question is, yes, I think there should be global standards and global norms, but the whole point of a company like Twitter or Facebook, and the reason why I'm a lot concerned about how powerful they've become, especially Facebook, is because they supersede all of those norms, right? Because what might harm India might actually do the opposite in Canada. And the idea that you just have to have this one sweeping set of rules that are going to work everywhere in the world is unlikely. That said, I do believe, especially global democracies, or like-minded democracies around the world, should be able to at least agree on a certain set of, as you said, harms. And, you know, you already have guiding principles on human rights. You already have some UN principles. I wish the UN were somehow a stronger governing body, but it's not. But There should be at least some certain basic, whether it's harms to children. Even I think part of the reason Facebook is so brazen is because they know they're not accountable to anyone, like anyone. Like the fact that Instagram would announce that they were starting an Instagram for children under 13, right in the midst of all the scrutiny they're getting, shows me two things. Not only are they completely, completely in denial and unaware of the harms that they're actually creating, but they're also completely just brazen about, yeah, you government can pretend you're screaming about us, but you can't touch us. And so I do hope that not just Europe and the US and Canada, but democracies in Latin America and democracies in Africa, there are democracies all over the world, even though a lot of Americans don't realize that, can at least agree on some set of standards. We will never agree globally on where to draw the lines around speech. As long as we make it about content moderation, as opposed to about the actual tools that these companies are using, then we will forever be bogged down in different norms and definitions about what free speech is. There's no definition for content moderation that is going to work around the entire world. There's just not. I mean, we can't even agree on anything here in the US. But rather than a global standard for should this one piece of speech stay up or go down, how about a global standard on how our human behavioral data can or cannot be used to target us with advertising? Right? As opposed to talking about the actual speech, can we have a global standard for the actual tools that are causing some of these problems?
So what type of regulation could actually help solve this breakdown of discourse and hold big tech companies accountable?
So that's one of the biggest problems, right? It's every time, if you look at any particular incident, as opposed to it's this whole entire machine, I always say, I don't know if Facebook's guilty or innocent in this particular case, but the fact that we will never know, because Facebook's the only one who can tell us whether or not their recommendation engines connected to extremists together, or whether or not they were negligent, because they're the only ones who actually get access to their own data. That's the problem. And so it's not that I think we should have government oversight, whether it's a new agency, whether it's a global body, whatever it is. It's not that I think people should be sitting there every day seeing all the data flowing through Facebook, should have access to all the secret sauce, all the code. That's not the point. But if when a particular situation happens, in the US at least, we almost never ever get to the point of actual discovery to see how their tools work, because the companies will claim Section 230 immunity. And so that's actually, I think there absolutely has to be some sort of oversight body that, it doesn't mean gets to constantly monitor everything happening on the platform, but when they want to dig in to a particular case, they do have oversight into how the tools actually worked. I mean, to go separate from, I know I'm all about accountability and the recommendation engines and the actual things that Facebook and other companies do control. They don't control if you write something hateful or I write something hateful, but they do control what they do with that hateful speech. And that's what I'm getting at. But let's even look at the data stuff and just look at what just happened. 533 million people's data is now from Facebook is now on this open website. And what they will say, talking about asymmetry of information, they'll make all these statements of like, oh yeah, but that's all publicly, you know, that's all information that you put out there. Or they will make these statements as opposed to just, yeah, well, wait a minute. You are actually legally required to disclose when this data leak, and you didn't. Under GDPR, you were legally required to. And that's, oh, what, it wasn't actually a leak. It was scraped. And they'll start changing your language. And here's the problem. There's no way to verify it. There's just no way to verify it, because they're the ones who hold all control of, when they say we catch whatever percentage of the hate speech through, I mean, there's no way to verify if that's true. Facebook gets to decide whether or not they want to give that information over. That's the asymmetry right there.
Yale made it clear that acting quickly is crucial.
The timeline, I believe, is critical. We are so past the point of how people even know what they can and can't trust. And a democracy cannot succeed if people have nothing to trust. If you can't trust the media, and I'm sorry, yes, the media, lots of different parts of the media have earned the fact that people don't trust them. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't trust any media. If you can't trust any government institution, if you can't trust the democratic process and that the election actually even happened in a legitimate way, then what's a democracy? It doesn't mean we're all going to die and life is going to be over. But democracy as we know it will be. And so then what comes next? I know that these companies think they're the grand disruptors, but they haven't actually offered us the, but when you disrupt democracy and you disrupt the media landscape, what alternative system are you offering us? Because your disruption has not offered us an alternative that is more peaceful and prosperous.
But it's not all doom and gloom. Yale offered some hopeful examples.
Is there anything that we should be looking to as an example of the good right now?
Sure. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a reason to get out of bed anymore if it was all doom and gloom all the time, which people seem to think is all I think. Listen, I think the fact that this conversation is so public now, I actually believe it will be not only just the next generation, but probably the global South and probably the parts of the world that have not been involved as much, who are going to figure out how to truly use technology to better serve humans. Right now, we're just all unfortunately suffering under the ideology of one person who decided that if we connect the world, everything's wonderful. And like 15 years later, that is still their mantra and still their ideology. I do think we've gotten to the point, though, where I actually find more inspiration. You know, I've worked with a lot of entrepreneurs. I spent the first part of my career in Africa. It is the part of the world that I was really most excited about and excited working in. And I still suspect some of the most awesome technology solutions that are very different in the terms of how they truly focus on human beings will probably come out of places like Africa. I think in the US, the problem is we have a lot of very idealistic technologists, but they keep coming at me with either I'm making the next Facebook. I don't really care about the next Facebook, to be frank. I don't really care about something that scales to 3 billion people. I care about something that's going to help my community or something maybe a little smaller, actually. And I just think there are other parts of the world who have been brought up with a completely different view of what matters. Here, what's funny is here in the US, these technologies were supposed to be about leveling the playing field so everyone has a voice. And in some respects, of course, technology has helped some underrepresented communities get much more voice. I don't discount that for a second. But in other countries, countries who have specifically really grown up under authoritarian regimes, that next generation truly understands what it means to not have a voice. And so those are the generations that I think will be approaching technology from a lens of truly not having a voice and how can they use it to protect those people as opposed to protecting the powerful.
Thank you for listening to Confluence. We hope you're able to walk away from today's episode with some new perspectives. My takeaways from today's episode include: tech has an outsized influence in our lives, and we need to remain cognizant and vigilant about the effects that these tools are having on our minds. Algorithmic environments are becoming more and more complex. It's increasingly difficult to keep up with the pace of change. We need to decide what values we have, and where to balance the scale between freedom of access and protection from harms. Across the board, we need ethics and oversight on public tech tools so our technology works for us rather than against us. This is true on an individual scale and on a macro scale as authoritarian interests harness new technologies. We also note that collaboration will be key to achieving any of this. And most importantly, tech should enhance our lives and our abilities, helping us to achieve our full potential. We need to carefully consider any tool that might prevent us from getting there. If you wanted to learn more about the Canadian tech landscape and the relationship between government and the private sector, we've included some resources in the show notes. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Yale Eisenstadt and Asa Raskin for being my guests. Production thanks to Wade Wallerstein, Kate Walter, Yi Boliu, Steph Colburn, Sophie Shin, and Ali Sirwa. I'm Rana Sarkar. Thank you for listening. Until next time.